Let's call our meeting of the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee together. My name is Bud Hicks. I serve as chairman of this committee. We have a number of important issues to talk about, and of course those issues are underscored by what's going on around the Lake Basin, fortunately not in the Lake Basin right now, but with the wildfires that we see throughout California and Nevada. So let's proceed. It's 12:51 p.m. Is that correct? 10:51 p.m. I'm looking at, 10:51 p.m. We're a little bit late, but let's get going. The first item on the agenda is the roll call to determine quorum. Mm-hmm. Now, before I turn it over to Maria to do that, I just would make one quick announcement, and that is that watching the earlier meeting, there is a lag here between those of us in the room and those of you who are remote working with us. And some of our staff are in a remote room. So we will have a lag of 5 to 10 seconds on some things. It's a little bit awkward, but we'll do our best. And with that said, I go to Maria in the other room.
Mrs. Sagaski.
Here.
Ms. Faustinos. Mr. Friedrich.
Here.
Mr. Hicks.
Here.
Mr. Lawrence.
Here.
Ms. Novosel.
Here.
Ms. Williamson.
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you very much. I'll now review our meeting rules for the day. To observe and participate in the meeting, please go to www.trpa.gov. Select July 29, 2021 Governing Board Meeting on the calendar and follow the link to the webinar. Members of the public can find all meeting materials there as well. In order to participate in this Forest Health and Wildfire Committee meeting, with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the GoToWebinar platform at the appropriate agenda item. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee. If you have contacted the TRPA for reasonable accommodation and received a unique PIN or dial-in, please make sure that you enter that PIN so that you may be identified and unmuted by TRPA staff. If you are using the GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it is opened in the Google Chrome browser and that you access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. If you are joining via the call-in number posted on our website, please note this is a listen-only option. If you wish to address the regional plan, if you wish to address the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee, you will need to log in via GoToWebinar on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, or dial your unique PIN number. To remote governing board members, if you wish to speak, please alert me via the chat function if you are online, or speak up if you are calling in. Please set your chat box now to message panelists and organizers to ensure that I see your message. Remote board members may only use the chat function to indicate desire to speak. This function must not be used to have sidebar conversations. Please remember to mute your mic unless speaking in order to cut down on background noise. Finally, I would like to have all remote members turn on their cameras, as we now have sufficient capacity on our platforms to accommodate everyone. For my colleagues in person today, please state your comments and questions one at a time using the button at the base of your microphone to mute or unmute yourself. If you are logged into the webinar on your own device, please mute and turn off your speakers to prevent any audio feedback. We will start today's meeting with public interest comments. If any member of the public wishes to address the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee on an item not on the agenda, please raise your hand now in the GoToWebinar to be unmuted by TRPA staff. I'll turn this over to our staff for a moment to manage public comment. Are there any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have one hand raised. This is for comments to the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee. Pete Todoroff, your hand is raised, so you are unmuted on my end if you'd like to address the committee.
Yes, this is Pete Todoroff from Inclaim Village. I would like to mention what has California's side done in their clearing of dead trees and getting away from the telephone lines and the power lines. Has there been any progress made on that since this meeting has met a few years ago? Thank you.
Thank you, Pete. Are there any other comments?
There are no other hands raised to address the committee, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Pete, to your comment, that's a good question, and we'll look into that and get back to you in the future on it.
Well, I can state that Liberty Energy has been very, very proactive in clearing around the power poles, and they're very much aware and have been very situationally in contact with local agencies, all letting us know that they are actively working on this.
Thank you, Sue.
Sure.
Okay, with that, we will close public comment and move on. The first item on our agenda is approval of the agenda. And I ask our staff, are there any changes to the agenda for us to consider today?
There are no changes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We will deem the agenda to be approved as posted. The next item is a very interesting item, and it's very timely. It relates to our discussions on the Tahoe West project, which is a very important project in terms of forest health and catastrophic wildfire prevention. So we have a briefing today on Watershed Erosion Prediction Project, WEPP, and Forest Treatments, Steep Slopes Within the Tahoe Basin. Your information on this item can be found at page 249 of your packet. With that, I will pass it off to Dr. Kat McIntyre, TRPA staff member, who will open this discussion for us. Thank you. Kat?
Thanks, Bud. I think my slide should be next. Yep, okay. Yep, so thank you, Mr. Chair, and all committee members. Today I will be doing an informational presentation with my two colleagues that you see here, Jonathan Long from the Pacific Southwest Research Station, and Mariana Dobre, I think I pronounced that right. Mariana, I'm sorry. from the University of Idaho. And so we are going to be talking about the Water Erosion Prediction Project and forest treatments on steep slopes within the Tahoe Basin. Next slide, please. So this is what the agenda will look like for the presentation. I will be covering the history and background, focusing on Lake Tahoe West and then zooming out to the larger basin. And then Jonathan and Mariana will take over and give you an introduction to the WET model and our preliminary results and the implications for the basin. And then I will wrap up with next steps, and we will open it up to the committee for questions and comments. Next slide, please. So a little bit of background on Lake Tahoe West. This collaboration has been going on for multiple years, about 5 to 6 years, amongst three lead agencies, the Tahoe Conservancy, the U.S. Forest Service, and TRPA, focusing on cross-jurisdictional holistic restoration of the west shore of the basin. There has been significant stakeholder and science engagement throughout the entire time. And it really all started with the landscape resilience assessment in 2017. That assessment was looking at a variety of factors across the west shore and how resilient they are currently and into the future. That ultimately fed into the landscape restoration strategy, which was completed in 2019, which highlights about 6 goals for the west shore, ecological goals for the west shore, but then also essentially defines how do we take the landscape resilience assessment and actually put it on the ground. And so that's where the landscape restoration strategy comes in. Next slide, please. So this is really what Lake Tahoe West is trying to get away from. So currently when we talk about restoration, it's been focused, fragmented, really following jurisdictional lines. Next slide, please. And this is what Lake Tahoe West strives for, is how do we do a coordinated, contiguous restoration? How do we look at the whole landscape, not just ownership, from the, you know, from the lake floor up to the top of the mountains? Next slide, please. So to give you an understanding of what this looks like, Lake Tahoe West right now is approximately 60,000 acres of a variety of restoration treatments. It is cross-jurisdictional, so when we were designing the activities, we were not looking necessarily at land ownership, but really ecological need. And it is a suite of different activities, including forest thinning, prescribed burning, watershed and stream restoration activities, and biomass utilization. Next slide, please. Historically, forest treatments have focused mostly on treating the wui. And so you'll see when you look at Lake Tahoe West, the idea was really how do we expand out from that, again, doing cross-jurisdictional work and moving more into the general forest. And when we start to do that, what we see are there are these areas of 30 to 50% slope within Lake Tahoe West, but also within the basin that would benefit from treatments. So what you're seeing on this map, the purple and orange, and I know this isn't a great map, but it works for the situation. The purple and orange are those areas that are actually everything above 30 to 50%. And right now, under our current code, the TRBA code, you are allowed to hand treat those, but you are not allowed to use mechanical ground-based equipment to treat slopes above 30%. And ultimately, there are efficiencies to be gained that are both financial and ecological from allowing ground-based mechanical equipment on those slopes above 30%. Hand thinning can be very expensive. It takes a lot of manpower and capacity. And additionally, you're leaving those piles on the landscape. So there's an ecological implication. You're not getting the potential benefits of being able to go through and do a broadcast burn after because you've got this on the landscape. Next slide, please. So the Emergency California Nevada Tahoe Basin Fire Commission report was produced in 2008. This was right after the Angora fire occurred in 2007. And they were this report essentially was a set of recommendations related to policy change, education, funding, government structure, and environmental practices as they relate to fire risk in the Tahoe Basin. As you can see, recommendation 17 was simplifying regulations. And when we dig into what that looked like, you can see subpart J, which is the commission recommends the TRPA, the Lahontan Water Board, USDA Forest Service, and other affected agencies amend their plan and ordinances to allow equipment use on slopes greater than 30% based on current and future technology and current forest practices to ensure resource protection. So this is a conversation that has been occurring for quite some time in the basin. Next slide, please. Additionally, we see that treatments really do help support decreasing fire severity and ultimately are effective. So what you're seeing on the left hand of your screen, you can see where the clear delineation, the clear line between what was treated on the right hand of that photo and what was not treated on the left hand of that photo. You see that the fire was burning clearly through the crowns of the trees And then once it hits the treatment, it drops down to the surface. And your photo on your right is exactly that, right? Is the area that was treated and where the fire was able to burn through and didn't torch the trees and wasn't running through the crowns. Next slide, please. Again, this is another example of how treatments can be effective. This is from the 2007 Angora fire. And the note below, our results show that fuel treatments generally performed as designed and substantially changed fire behavior and subsequent fire effects to forest vegetations. So again, you're seeing on our left side, that's treated. We can see that, it's thinned out. And then on the right is an untreated forest. Next slide, please. So given all of these factors, given everything that I've just discussed, we felt it was important, keeping in mind those restoration goals from Lake Tahoe West, that we need to explore the environmental aspects of treatments on steep slopes. And when I say steep slopes, I mean slopes 30 to 50%. And so that is why we felt it was important to engage our science partners that have worked on Lake Tahoe West for quite some time to assess erosion effects of a variety of restoration treatments on hill slopes and soil types within the Lake Tahoe West landscape and across the basin. And so, as I mentioned, I have Jonathan Long from the Pacific Southwest Research Station, which is an arm of the Forest Service, and Mariana Dobre from the University of Idaho, who are going to take over the presentation now and talk about their work. Go for it. Thank you.
Still muted, Mariana.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. I have to change the microphone. Thank you. The next slide, when I put the presentation together, I had some animation. I didn't know I will not control the slides. So I will say click until all the pieces are on the slide. So next slide. Maybe two clicks here. So the main question was, should we expect water quality impacts from allowing ground-based mechanical treatment on steeper slopes? These, like Kat mentioned, are the ones between 30 and 50%. And to answer this question, we applied a basin scale hydrologic model called WEP, or Water Erosion Prediction Project. And then based on the results of this model, we've done some supplemental statistical analysis to actually get to this question. And this is what we'll present today. Next slide. Before we dig into the results, what is this Water Erosion Prediction Project, or WEP model? The model has been developed since 1980s at the National Soil Erosion Lab by Agricultural Research Service. And it's a model developed to assess the effects of management on soil erosion, maybe mainly on agricultural fields. Since then, the model has been developed to be applied to forests and currently is used to simulate harvest, wildfires, prescribed burning and mulching from and other various managements. Specifically for Lake Tahoe, we've been working in the basin for 14 years and we worked on improving the model specifically for Lake Tahoe to develop management files that are specific for the basin. So over the last 14 years, we calibrated and validated the model at various watersheds. Other information that the model uses is free information on topography, on the soils, and as well as on the climate. Ultimately, the outputs from this model are surface runoff, soil erosion, including very fine particles, which are the ones that we're interested in, as well as phosphorus within hill slopes and watershed around the basin. Next slide. Before we jump into the results, how good is this model? We initially did a calibration on the model. So the map on the left shows you the outline of the basin and the green areas are watersheds. And we had at these watersheds observed long-term stream flow and sediment data. So this is where we actually applied the model, calibrated it, found calibrating parameters and then applied all those calibrating parameters to the rest of the watershed, the rest of the basin. So the map on the right shows all the watersheds within the Lake Tahoe Basin. next click. Once we calibrated a model, then we developed an online interface for this model to run every single scenario that we considered in this project and get results for runoff and erosion on every area in the basin, or almost every area in the basin. This is just the two maps are an example of runoff and erosion. The lighter areas represent areas with more runoff and more erosion. This is just to give you an idea of how the model can be used to visualize the results, almost in a Google type of map. Next slide. Now, how accurate is this model? Like I said, we've been working on this model specifically for Lake Tahoe for many years. So how accurate is it? We have other statistics, like very technical statistical analysis that I'm not going to describe, but this is just a visual representation. And this shows the stream flow by year. So the total amount of stream flow at multiple watersheds, the 18 watersheds that we modeled. And the blue line represents observed, and the red line represents simulated. So next click here, we found overall, based on this visual analysis and the statistical analysis, we found good agreement between observed and simulated. Next slide, two clicks. Three clicks, actually. Okay. These are the results. We won't go into details, but the results for the sediment yield and for the phosphorus look more or less similar. So overall, we concluded that a model can be applied to all of these watersheds in the basin. Next slide. Also here, maybe we can do three clicks. And two more. Thank you. Okay. Once we had a calibrated model that we trusted, that it works really well for the in the basin, we changed key soil and management parameters to simulate several management conditions. The table at the top shows the canopy, shows the ground cover. So the ground cover is the most important variable that drives soil erosion. So if you imagine an undisturbed forest that has 100% cover, so it has a very deep duff layer. When it rains, the soil is protected, so it's not gonna erode. When we thin the forest, we disturb it a little bit. So at that point, we could potentially increase the erosion. So we decrease the ground cover to values that are more similar to what's found in the basin. Those are 85%, 93%, and 96%. The 85% is the most aggressive thinning. We added it because we wanted to see if we find any differences from this aggressive thinning. We also looked at the low severity fire within the basin, moderate severity fire, and the high severity fire. So these have ground cover of 80%, 50%, and 30% for the high severity fire. So we considered these scenarios. We also considered three additional wildfire conditions, but we're not going to discuss about those now. The image on the right shows an example of a post-treatment forest floor residual ground cover. This is a similar coniferous forest to what we can find in the basin. And you can see the patchiness that resulted from this burning. We can see pine needles and also areas with charcoal and areas with ash. So it's a really mixed ground cover for a prescribed burning. This would be similar to a low severity fire in the basin. So once we change these parameters in the model, like I said, we had a lot of information from previous studies to parameterize the model. We ran the model for all these management conditions. The map shows the sediment yield. From the left to the right, we have an undisturbed condition, a thinned condition. This is with the most aggressive one with 85% ground cover, so residual ground cover. Next one is a low severity and a high severity. The redder the areas, the more erosion it is. So you can clearly see how the high severity fire generates more erosion overall in most of the west of Lake Tahoe, if it was to happen. Next slide. Now, once we ran the model for all these scenarios, we did a post-modeling data analysis. And this means that for all of the hill slopes seen in the in Lake Tahoe, we had a lot of various information. So we took that information and we did some statistical analysis. But what is a hill slope? So just to break it down a little bit, if you see the map on the left is a map of the, Lake Tahoe and a circle around the Blackwood watershed. So that's a watershed. And the map on the right, it shows a schematic of a watershed where we break it down in hill slopes and channels. So that's just an example of a small watershed with five hill slopes and two channels. For Blackwood watershed, when we split it, we found 623 hill slopes. So these are subunits of this watershed. So that's how you can view them. Next click. Okay, so once we have all this information, we performed summaries of the data, and we also did map calculations and other statistical analysis to initially understand the effects of these treatments on soil erosion. We also wanted to identify variables that are driving soil erosion, so it's not just the slope or precipitation, or what are those variables, the key variables that are driving soil erosion. And ultimately, we wanted to get to our main question, to analyze the data by steep slope and see if steep slopes will cause more erosion in general. Next slide. Our results, we have two links here. The link on the top would, for anybody who is curious, would take you to the actual model run. So all of these are online and anybody can access them. So these are the results for the entire basin. The link on the bottom is actually the statistical analysis based on those results. So those are available. Next slide. Maybe a few more clicks, maybe three. One more. Thank you. So we can get into the results now, or some of the conclusions overall. We can't present all of the results. The conclusions are based on multiple analysis, but here we just wanted to show you a little bit of these results. So the first conclusion that we had is that slopes between 30 and 50% do not appear to be a major driver of soil erosion. So the table on the top shows you the sediment yield for undisturbed conditions and thinned. So this is the most aggressive thinning treatment that I mentioned by slope. So under 30%, 30 to 50%, and over 50%. So overall, we can see that we found low erosion rates from the thinning in general. Now, if we zoom in to these 30 to 50% slopes, so now we look at the table on the bottom. We have the same sediment yield, but now we also added the slope length. So we're only looking at the slope length for these steep slopes between 30 and 50%. So we see that it's actually the longer slope that generate more erosion. So these are slopes that are longer than 300 meters. So we concluded, like I said, from other analysis as well, but we concluded that slope length is a more important predictor of erosion than slope steepness. And we know that actual treatments are unlikely to treat the entire length of the slope at one single time. So when a treatment is done, the slopes can be broken into multiple sections. So mitigation could include this untreated buffer areas within the slopes. Next slide. I mentioned that we also did map calculations. So we had all these results in digital format. So we did some map calculations to help managers identify some of these hill slopes that could potentially generate more erosion. This is just an example where we're showing here the absolute difference in sediment yield between a thinning, an aggressive thinning, and current conditions. And the map shows that the absolute difference in sediment yield. orange areas, it means we get more erosion from thinning, and darker areas or yellow, those are areas where we don't get a lot of erosion. So the maps could be used visually to better understand where on the hill slope we have issues. So I will pass it on to Jonathan now to continue with some of our conclusions.
Yeah, thank you. So just pointing out that this slide is just kind of, you know, what the immediate effects could be of doing treatment. And I'll draw your attention. There's a long, thin red unit there. And we flip to the next slide. I'll talk more about that unit and other issues. The another analysis we did was kind of based on assumptions for Lake Tahoe West, where we consider what the potential benefits of doing thinning are on reducing soil erosion by avoiding more severe wildfires. And so some of Mariana's work projected what soil burn severity would be like, which is different from vegetation burn severity. This is just describing how the soils are affected from the wildfires. And she looked at Angora Fire, Emerald Fire in the basin, as well as the King Fire outside of the basin, to get an understanding of what the soil burn severity would be like, and generally found that we'd actually expect a lot of moderate severity burn in untreated situations from wildfires. So we're certainly seeing examples of very severe wildfire behavior where you could get into that high soil burn severity, but our assumption was just that by doing treatments, you would reduce the soil burn severity from moderate to low. And then we compared what that benefit from doing treatments would be compared to the need to do frequent thinning in order to maintain the condition. So we assumed that you would have to thin on average about 3 times in 50 years, which is kind of an approximate return interval for a wildfire. So if you're thinning every 16 or 17 years, then you could displace what the effects of a wildfire would be if you didn't do any treatments. And so this is just kind of a way to think about this potential benefit over a large area. But I mentioned that steep slope that previously showed that it was in red because there was a greater likelihood of increasing erosion due to treatment. But this area on this map, where the dark green shows the potential benefits in terms of avoiding erosion by mitigating the wildfire. So even though you may have some areas that may be more sensitive to potentially to some treatments, those could also be the same areas where you get benefits from avoiding wildfires. So it's a complicated kind of analysis, but this map in general shows that most of the areas you're looking at, you're going to get a benefit from doing treatments if you're reducing the soil burn severity from wildfires. Okay, next slide. And so that's why we conclude that allowing mechanical thinning of forest areas in this 30 to 50% slope is expected to reduce erosion impacts from wildfires over time. Mariana's also, her results show that the risks of treatment are generally pretty low in the forest covered areas compared to other vegetation types. Shrub dominated areas and grass dominated areas are at higher risk, but those are likely to be treated with prescribed burning rather than mechanical equipment. So they're not as relevant, but there's another potential benefit from doing the thinning in the forest is that you may reduce the extent of wildfire in some of these shrub-dominated areas. So there's a potential shadow benefit that we're not necessarily accounting for here, but that's important to keep in mind. Next slide. In the analysis that we're doing, ground cover, as Mariana pointed out, is a key driver of sediment yield. We assumed relatively modest reductions in ground cover from 100% down to 85%. Representatives from private industry that are working on steep slopes report that they would expect residual ground cover in this range, which is actually a lot higher than a lot of the standards, which require about 50% ground cover to be maintained. But they pointed out that they're using slash mats where they're knocking down some of the branches of the trees before they drive over it and leaving that as ground cover where soil erosion is a concern. And I'll talk a little bit more about that with some visuals. Another concern that does exist on treating slopes with mechanical treatment is rutting or compaction. But we assume that existing requirements and other practices will address that risk, that you've got best practices that will ensure that if you're using equipment, you're not damaging those soils in those ways. And then if you go to the next slide, I'll explain why we think that's a a reasonable assumption? Well, first, this is field research in the Tahoe Basin that was done, published in 2016. It was done through the Stiftelma program. But they looked at actual ground treatments, burning and mastication in particular. And in their study, they didn't look at slopes in, really in the 30 to 50% range. They went from 12 to 33%. But within those ranges, first they found that just having as much as 25% ground cover in patchy arrangements was enough to really reduce erosion rates to very low levels. It was only when you had about 0% ground cover that you had high sediment yield. And they also found that slope was not a significant predictor of sediment yield. So this is just some field research that echoes what we're seeing in our modeling work. Next slide. And so it's important to consider that there's a lot more newer equipment options that reduce soil impacts on steeper slopes, especially equipment that have flexible tracks or frames, so they kind of adjust to the undulations of the terrain, and they reduce the likelihood of gouging or displacing the soils. Another option that is being used is tethering, where you attach the equipment to a line, and that holds the equipment in a more constrained area to minimize the soil disturbance. And these are some examples from a recent field study in Oregon that was looking at tethered equipment. Next slide. There you go. This is another slide from one of my colleagues who's a soil scientist in Oregon. This is showing us a greater than 60% slope where they're using some of this advanced harvesting equipment with tracked wheels and tethering. And you can see that they've laid down slash mats to operate on. So this is just showing some of the best practices that are being used in different contexts on these steeper slopes. And okay, next slide. So in general, the modeling, the field research that's been done and discussions with soil scientists studying practices on steep slopes indicate that mechanical harvesting can be conducted in ways that minimize reductions in ground cover and avoid increased erosion in detectable amounts. I mean, there's some risk of increasing erosion, but the levels that Mariana is reporting are, you wouldn't be likely to detect them at all in watershed scale modeling or monitoring because they're so small. These approaches rely on advanced techniques and applications of best management practices to avoid impacts. So, for example, avoiding impacts on wet soils. And this is, you know, similar to what's been done in terms of working in some of the wetland areas in the basin using cut-to-length harvesting equipment. And then the final point is that modeling results indicate that treatments in many of these forested areas could generate a net water quality benefit by reducing the soil burn severity from wildfires. So we think that's an important consideration. And back to Kat, I think.
Yep. Thanks, Jonathan and Mariana. So next steps, what does this all mean? Well, TRPA staff feels that this is really the foundational analysis that is going to support ultimately, an analysis and documentation needed to propose a basin-wide code amendment regarding mechanical ground-based equipment on slopes 30 to 50%. And so we will be working with Mariana and Jonathan and Mason with TRBA to figure out what this will look like and our next steps forward in the coming months. Next slide, please. So with that, I will hand it back to Bud and we can field any committee member comments or questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kat, and thank you very much to Dr. Long and Dr. Dobre. That's a very interesting presentation, and it gives us a lot to digest. But let me back up. I was on that Emergency Fire Commission back in 2007, which, by the way, was 14 years ago. And at that time, they made this recommendation. The committee made the recommendation, and I recall it very well, that the agencies within the district look at the question of allowing mechanical equipment on slopes of greater than 20 to 30% in using both current equipment, that's 14-year-old equipment, and future technology. So I'm glad that we're getting around to it now, and it's long overdue. It took us a while to get to the equipment over snow code amendments, if you'll recall. But it is important, and this just brings back a flood of memories of the discussions at the emergency committee that was formed by the two states 14 years ago. So, my position on it is quite clear. I fully endorse the idea of the code amendment and facilitating this type of equipment on steep slopes in the basin. And, you know, further, I'll have a comment later on, I think that given what we see happening in and around the basin, not in the basin, but around the basin today, with these fires that have circled the basin over the last several years, I have to believe that public sentiment is we need to do something. We can't sit on these things for 14 years. And so with that said, that's my position on it. But I would like to open this to comments by our committee members. And so for those who are participating, our committee members by remote connection to us, give me a chat indication if you have a comment. Otherwise, I'll just sort of go down the table here, and I first ask Jim Lawrence. Jim, do you have any comments? I'm getting even with you for that long meeting.
I know. It's like, of course I have a comment. When do I not? my comment is great appreciation to the team for really taking a look at this issue. You know, the narrative that we've had for a number of years now is how do we increase the pace and scale? And when we're looking at the Lake Tahoe Basin, in my opinion, and talking with folks, we really can't increase the pace and scale of these activities until we really take a hard look at the current restrictions on doing work on slopes greater than 30%. More close to home for me and my department, you know, we're focused on, you know, Lake Tahoe, Nevada State Park, East Shore, and our urban lots in Glen Village down here at Kingsbury, and also Van Sickle. We've made a pretty good amount of progress, but you can only get so far on the Nevada side of the basin until you get into steeper slopes. And so this is really a critical issue for us. To address, we want to do it right, but if we're going to increase the pace and scale, particularly on the Nevada side, we have to address the 30% slope issue. So I guess my question would be, given the tremendous amount of research that's been done, when do we anticipate seeing code amendment language? Because as you said, Mr. Chair, we can't wait another 12 or 14 years. And so that would be my question.
Yeah, I can answer that.
I see you shaking your head.
Well, I was going to
give you
the first shot at this, but we are currently starting into the process of the environmental review on this and are working out the kind of scope and boundaries of that and who will do what portions of this. But the reason that we brought this forward right now to the committee is to show you that we are actually teed up quite well right now on this 30% code, you know, slope code change. So we're looking for the most expeditious way that we can move into the environmental review of this right now.
Sue Novosel, our vice chair on this committee. Do you have any comments or questions?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Chair. I'm really excited to see this, and you know, I'm data driven like most of us are, and to see the data out there that in a way kind of contradicts what we've been thinking of in the past, in that the greater the slope, the more difficult the erosion, and how do you deal with it? And love the idea of taking the slash and being able to actually put it to use. That's really ingenious in my mind and really great to see, and very, very excited to get to the point where we can actually do what you were talking about, Chair, and that is start moving forward and getting this on the ground, because it is definitely needed. All we have to do is look around and realize we're in trouble. And I think one of my concerns is, and it's not something I don't know if you can address here today, is you're talking about the slash, about the biomass. How do you get rid of that? What do we do with it? I know it's an issue. ongoing issue that we have. And, you know, as we talk about having more treatment, obviously we're going to have that conversation of what do you do with the treatment? You can use that is ground cover for so long, but we obviously realize we're going to have to get in there and move it out. So just another thing to think about, we're going to be in there mechanically taking this slash out. Can we do that to somehow move it? Is that part of the conversation or is that going to be the next steps?
Sue, thank you. And that raises another issue is access to the steep slopes. It's one thing when the steep slope is right off of Highway 50, as it is, for example, in Glenbrook, but on the West Shore, I'm not sure that there are easy access routes into those steep slope areas. And, you know, that just raises the question of the forest access roads and all of that. So how do you get there? Then how do you do it? And how do you get it out of there? It raises a whole scope of questions. Barbara Sagaski, I'll ask you if you have any questions or comments.
I do, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the background 14 years ago and the current, and thanks to the team for your comments and your proposals. I guess my concerns would be about the treatment. Are we seeing any impact to the environment, the animals, the trees, any, et cetera? And then because of the new fires that are here and with us now, are we able to incorporate any of this with what's going on as far as the new fires? That's kind of a concern. Are we preparing for future because we know there are going to be future. There's no way around it. So I'm looking at that. More than anything else, but I just want to thank you and again thank the team for what you're doing. I didn't see in what I heard that it's been 14 years. I haven't seen that, but I don't know how current any of the work is done when you started, when you finished. If maybe we could know some of that, and then just what it's done to wildlife or anything around there, the treatment. But thank you very much for enlightening us. Appreciate it.
John Frederick, any comments?
Yeah, great work. And I would just say to me, the bottom line selling point is the cost benefit, the avoided erosion from moderate or severe fire compared to the somewhat minimal, especially with the ground cover scenarios, the erosion from treated areas. And one would imagine since 2007 that factor in doing that cost benefit analysis has only increased the odds of such a wildfire. And I just wonder in your modeling, Mariana and Jonathan or Kat, whoever wants to answer that, I'm just curious, what kind of factor do you give to the likelihood of fire? I mean, I think we'd all just say intuitively, we know it's going up everywhere. But we will increasingly will go up. But if you want to just speak to that in modeling, you know, the benefit from avoiding those fires and how you calculate that delta, that factor for the likelihood of that of those erosion, that erosion that you're avoiding.
So first, when we looked at these results, actually when we were designing the project. We were thinking to apply thinning only on certain hill slopes, or wildfire. But then we decided that we should actually burn every hill slope in the basin. So the results that you're seeing are, we're assuming that a fire would happen in the basin uniformly, or that a thinning would happen on every single forested hill slope, which is unrealistic. So In reality, we would thin less hill slopes, or the wildfire would burn less hill slopes. So I believe that in reality, the results would show that there is even less erosion than we're showing here. So our results were more the most aggressive or the worst case scenarios that could possibly happen. In terms of would a wildfire happen? We did an analysis where we predicted the soil burn severity based on, like Jonathan mentioned, based on Angora Fire, Emerald Fire, and King Fire. And obviously, it's a modeling. So every time we do a modeling, there's a chance that we're wrong, right? But at least the modeling results show that we're not going to get those super high severity fires, and we mainly get the moderate and low severity within the basin. So different areas are more at risk. But we have those results, three scenarios that we didn't show today, but we have them as well. So we can look at those too.
Thanks. I'm just posting a couple links in the a link in the chat to a science summary report for Lake Tahoe West that we address some of these other issues in terms of the idea of opening up roads, potential water quality issues around that, impacts to wildlife as well. And so for some of that landscape modeling we did for Lake Tahoe West, we did a lot more to understand what the wildfire regime would look like going forward. I mentioned during the talk that we did kind of a simplified assumption of saying, well, if you treat, you know, every 17 years and you had a wildfire come through the same area every 50 years, you know, kind of what those trade-offs would look like. But you could certainly, you know, change those numbers around. And, you know, with the kinds of fire activity we're seeing with climate change, we certainly expect a lot more wildfires to happen going forward. And our modeling in the Lake Tahoe West work demonstrates that, which also suggests another possible benefit of doing the work now of treating these forests is while climate change is also likely to change the intensity of storms in the future. And so there may be a benefit from getting in there and doing the treatments now before those storm intensities increase in the future. So there's a lot of factors to consider if you're trying to look at this over the, you know, a long period and large landscapes. But if you're interested in looking at some of those trade-offs, we have a lot of findings in the summary report that I linked, and all that information is going into peer-reviewed journal articles that should be published in the next couple months.
Thank you. That's very helpful and very appreciated. I think that we've gone through all of the comments I've been indicated so far, but it's time, I think, to go to public comment on this item. And so I'll go to our staff now. If any member of the public wishes to address the Forest Health and Wildfire Committee on this agenda item, please raise your hand now in the GoToWebinar section to be unmuted by TRPA staff. And with that, I'll turn it over to our staff to see if we have any public comments at this particular time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pete Todoroff, you are unmuted on my end, and you can address the committee with your comments.
Hi, I'm Pete Todoroff from Pinkline. I just have concerns about the wildlife, about the treatment of the property, the Forest Department. And I don't know if there's been a study on that or not, but I really do have major concerns about that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there are no other hands raised to comment on this item.
Thank you. We will close public comment at this point. And I would ask our committee members, do you have any further comments from the committee on this matter? Barbara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if they could answer his question along with mine about how it affects either wildlife or any type of vegetation, and then also to address when they started and when they finished. Thank you.
And if our presenters could maybe take that one on, it would be appreciated.
Yeah, I will post a link to some of the other publications about wildlife impacts.
Committee member Lawrence just indicated he can answer.
real quick, just a follow up?
Yes,
quick.
Sue.
Just a quick follow up. What is you gave out quickly a web page to look at that up, your study up, and I couldn't find it. Can you give me that real quick so I can take a look?
Yeah, that's a summary report. It should be on our
staff could supplement our materials after this meeting. And
that'd be great because I
didn't see it.
Yeah, I can share the links, and we also have field studies that have been done.
I'll ask Kat McIntyre and our staff to supplement.
That would be.
Also, in terms of timeline, we looked, but
Barbara, you have one more point. Okay, thank you very much. And Dr. Long and Dr. Dobre, thank you very much for your time and your assistance today. And thank you for your patience waiting for us. We know that you undoubtedly have other things calling your attention. And we truly appreciate your assistance. We appreciate the information you've given us. As I indicated, there's a lot for us to digest, but we truly appreciate your comments and your time. Thank you. Let's see. We're now on it. Well, we finished agenda committee comments. Are there any other committee comments at this point?
Real quick comment. Yeah, we have the August. You know, August is Tahoe season, as sometimes I call it. We have federal events coming up. Great discussion. We need to do more work, obviously, with forest health and pre-suppression activity. But suppression is key. I mean, we talk a lot about getting our forest conditions in resilient conditions, not just because, you know, not with an eye toward in-basin fires, but fires that might come into the basin. You know, the Tamarack fire, and, you know, Commissioner Rice is here, and I know he had a briefing this morning, that, you know, listening to the Forest Service, that largely was a result of limited resources. Lots of lightning strikes. Limited resources, you can't get to every strike. And so I hopefully, you know, all of us, as we have our interactions coming up in August, we need to talk about getting more resources, helitack crews, super scoopers positioned down in Minden and Gardnerville and in the area so that we don't, or the Forest Service isn't having to make those agonizing choices of where to send their resources when they only have so much. So that's my soapbox.
Thank you, Jim. That's an excellent point. And, you know, one other, I caused me to have one further thought on this. I would ask Joanne and our staff if they wouldn't mind preparing a summary report or something for us on where they are on the Tahoe West project now. Is it moving along on its time schedule as previously announced, or have we hit some unexpected delays? And if we have, what is the delay? My patience is thin after 14 years from our original committee on all of these projects. It's not, you know, so it's important for us to know those projects that are on the table now, like Tahoe West, that they're on track and moving. And if they aren't, why not? And then further, is there anything we can do to push gently our partners to get these things moving? Thank you.
We will do that. It's important that we bring in partners to give you an update on that.
Thank you, Joanne. With that, is there a motion to adjourn our meeting? There is a motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Unanimously passed. We are adjourned. Thank you.